Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey Greasers, hope you're having an okay week. Thank you so much for choosing Griefcast and choosing to join me again. And thank you for your incredibly lovely words on the episodes we've had so far of this series, series 5. And a bit terrifying, but here we are. If you are enjoying the show, please, as ever, do rate and review it. You can review the whole show or you can review a particular episode if you really like that episode. It obviously massively helps other people find the show and helps me continue to do it. And do subscribe as well so that you never miss an episode. This week, I'm talking to writer and poet Shemaine Suliman. Shemaine is originally from London. She's written and spoken on race and identity for such publications as The Guardian, The Independent, the BBC, and lots more. She also has a debut poetry collection called Outside Looking On. I actually came across Shemaine because she co-edited an incredible book called The Good Immigrant, the USA version, with past guest Nikesh Shulkar. Nikesh got in touch with me to say, Shemaine has an amazing story. I think you should hear it. And they very kindly sent me a copy of the book. Now, I know on this show I get sent lots of books about death, and you'll hear me say in this episode this book isn't especially focused on that, but I can't recommend it enough. It's such an interesting collection of essays, especially at the times that we are living right now. So if you're looking for something that is poignant and relevant, but not entirely about death, The Good Immigrant USA, I can very much recommend. Shemaine came in to talk to me about her grandfather, who was killed during the 1960s as part of the Cypriot Civil War. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with writer Shemaine Suliman. Hello.
Hi.
Your book, well, the book you've edited and written for, The Good Immigrant USA, has just come out. Is
yes,
that right?
It has. It came out in America a few weeks ago and in England just last week.
Just last week. This is very exciting. I'm looking at it. I'm holding a copy of it. It's very exciting. It's exciting to see it.
It is really exciting to see
it.
It doesn't feel real.
And so we should say that this sort of came about because there's an English book called The Good Immigrant, which was edited by Nikesh Shulkar, who was also a previous guest on Griefcast. And then you wrote an essay for that,
is that
right?
Yeah, I was a contributing writer for the first book.
And so then how did the American one come about then?
I was already living in New York when the first book came out. And then after the success of that book, which we weren't expecting at all, Nikesh and I were just talking about my different experience of being an immigrant in America. and the nuances around race. And then the more we were just talking about it on a general level, the more it made sense to turn those conversations that we were having as friends into another collection and see where that took us.
It's so good. So fucking good.
Thank you.
Like, I get sent a lot of books, mostly on death. So this was like a bit of a breath of fresh air, because although it's about a really hard topic, it doesn't start with the phrase, like, honestly, I got sent one on the weekend, which just like, it was a test copy, which like, I thought he'd left the house, but he was dead. And I was just like, oh God, I don't want to start reading this. So just to get something that isn't completely full of people dying was quite nice. But there's contributions from all sorts of people, but it's really interesting, I think, because obviously we were just talking about this. We get a lot of American culture in our life. So I think we were just talking about people not knowing where Wales is or where Turkish Cyprus is. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, I know where Missouri is. You know, I know these, like, weird things because of watching stuff. But I feel like this is such a different side of stuff that I haven't heard. So the first one I read was, I don't know how to say her name.
Porshista,
about being an Iranian-American. Yeah. And it's such a good essay.
It's
incredible. My God.
Absolutely. She's an incredible, amazing, very beautiful writer.
Yeah.
And it's a very powerful essay to start the book with.
And just to start that, thinking about being an Iranian-American, growing up in California, and just, it is, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but it is voices, I think, that you don't really hear of in mainstream media.
Absolutely.
What's it been like for you then, living in New York? Why did you move to New York, first of all? Was that for work?
No, I moved because my partner at the time got a job out there.
We
moved for his job. And then, for whatever reason, I ended up staying even after it didn't work out between us. I think a lot of that was also true. I remember I came back when Brexit was happening. And then as soon as Brexit happened, I was like, yeah, I don't think I can move back here.
Wow.
And then I went back to New York and then Trump happened. So.
Oh, my God.
So it didn't really work out that well. But it's an interesting experience. It's like I grew up in London. I was born in London, but my parents migrated from Cyprus. They're Turkish Cypriot. And I always felt like an immigrant here, even though I was born here. And I've spent a lot of time being like, I'm not Turkish enough, I'm not English enough, I'm not white enough, I'm not brown enough, I'm not Muslim enough. And I didn't really know what I was. Like, I've had this massive identity crisis. And then I moved to America and I was like, oh, I'm a Londoner. Like that, like that, like that's it. That's all it is.
Yeah, your essay is fascinating about people not being able to identify you because of your skin being, you know,
much lighter.
And what's the phrase you use?
White passing?
White passing, yeah. But there's another phrase, someone calls you something.
Oh, spicy white?
Spicy white, spicy
someone calls
white.
Me spicy white.
Which I was like, oh, that's such a great, I love that language. I thought it was really, really funny and really, I knew exactly what you meant. But yeah, that's weird, isn't it? And I think we were talking before we started recording about how powerful London is. And I don't know if you feel it, I get very irritated when people slag off London.
Very annoyed.
Because I feel like it's one of the greatest places in the world.
Yeah,
really. And I've been to New York and it was one of the few places in the world I thought, all right, you're as good as London. I could live here.
It is like, there's a lot about it that's very similar to London. But actually, when you start to dig a little bit deeper, which I guess you have to do when you're living somewhere, actually there are a lot of very significant differences.
Yeah.
I don't find it to be a particularly diverse place.
No, that's true. The diversity. I suppose the one thing I had no problem was the pace of it.
Right.
Because London, it felt like it was on the same tempo
Absolutely.
As London.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I didn't feel like, you know, when you go somewhere quiet and you're like, why is no one moving? I don't like it. I don't like it's quiet. I don't like when people stroll. Why are you strolling? Like, get out my way. What's happening? So you're right. But you're right. It's not quite as, I suppose maybe is the centre not as diverse as London is? Like,
I mean, like Brooklyn is diverse in like the truest sense of the word, but I find it a lot more segregated. And I find that also, like, I got into trouble for saying this the other day, but I do feel like it's true. Like, I feel like America does lack a lot of nuance around things. And I think that's also because it's such a vast country that they're still trying to understand what one side of America looks like to the other. So they're not really looking to see what's happening in Europe or what's happening in the Middle East or, like, you know, what this Bollywood film's saying or what, you know, what this, you know, Arab musician is. Whereas we have a lot more access to that and a lot more interest in that, I think, largely because our neighbours are so mixed in London.
I think also, like, geography is so massive. Like you said, like, the geography of a country affecting a culture, it can be so easy sometimes. I mean, look, you know, why people say we're an island nation when you look at Brexit.
Right, exactly. We still have
that mentality. And I think you're right, America is so huge. You know, like, the joke is, isn't it? Like, it's 20 years behind in different places.
It is, yeah. No, absolutely, absolutely. It's, yeah, it's an interesting place. It has... I moved when Obama was president.
Saint Lord Obama.
I know, right? And then I was there the whole way through, like, Trump's campaign, obviously, and then, like, now Trump's presidency. And it is a different place.
Yeah.
And it's like... That his attitude trickles down into people's day-to-day living and approaches to each other. Like, even if they're not Trump supporters, you still see that, like, if your president and your government is representing something so self-serving and that's the message that you're giving to the rest of the world, even if you don't support his politics, you end up sort of embodying that, like, self-serving mentality. People have got way more selfish and way more aggressive in the last however long it's been, 2 years.
I think, it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And this is a terrible, terrible example, but I'm really good at them. When you are filming something, they have, like, the cast list, right? And there's someone who's number one on the cast list. It's obviously the lead. That means they're in the most things. And whenever I always say, like, whoever number one is on that sheet, it trickles down. So if number one acts, number one and two and three, I guess, if they act very humbly and they're kind and they, you know, they're not pulling shit, then the crew relax and everyone lower relaxes and it becomes, like, a really nice place to work.
Mm-hmm.
But if number one, two, and three pull shit and throw strops or something, like, it sets the tone of that environment.
For sure.
And so you can tell, you know, sometimes you work on a film or a TV show just for one day and you come in, you'd be like, oh, okay, number one, two, and three don't like not being important. And so that's what's happening here. So everyone's worried about them. And it's like, we're such tribal human beings, are so engrossed in tribes that it makes sense. Like, Trump is number one. He's behaving like, of course, how can it not affect you? Or even if it's, you know, even if you disagree, you're angry because number one is so awful.
Right, exactly.
So then you're angry, and so he's angry. Everyone's angry.
Everyone's angry all of the time.
Yeah.
Like, it does trickle down in psychology.
That's obviously where you're at the moment, where we're all at the moment, sadly and unfortunately. But who are we remembering today?
I think my granddad.
Okay. And what was your granddad's name?
His name was Suleiman Recep.
Suleiman Recep.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great name. What does Suleiman mean?
I don't know what it means, but in Turkish, in Cyprus, like, before 1974, the way the names worked was that you took your father's first name as your last name, and then you kept, and then it changed after 1974. So his father's first name was Recep, so then he was Suleiman Recep, so then my dad is Recep Suleiman.
Wow.
And then if that had continued with me, but I was born after 1974, I would have been Shemen Recep. But because by that point the war went into, like, a ceasefire and people registered their names properly, I didn't continue
with that. So you
became
Shemen Suleiman.
Yeah. But only in this country.
Wow.
Because in Cyprus I am Shemen Shehitolu, which means martyr's son. So after my grandfather was killed in the Cyprus Civil War, the name that my dad registered for their family was martyr's son, Shehitolu. So actually when I'm there, that's the name that I use. No one knows me as Shemen Suleiman when I'm in Cyprus. It's a lot.
I find stuff like that just so mad. I always ask people what the name means because I find it's just, again, it's these tiny signifiers that communicate so much and mean so much to us. And, like, the fact that, you know, my dad is the one who's dead. My dad was the Welsh one. So I have this weird Welsh name, which I'm very, like, connected to, even though I grew up in North London and I upset Welsh people all the time.
Right.
At least, can you speak Turkish?
I can. I've got a terrible English accent. But at least you can.
I can't speak any Welsh and they get real upset about it.
Right.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So he's Suleiman Recep. So he died, what year was this?
He died in 1964.
Okay, so you never met him?
No. My dad was 13 when he died. And the civil war started... I mean, there was like discomfort happening in that country for like years before, because it was a British colony for a period of time, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, I mean, we do get everywhere. Yep. It's just like McDonald's. It's
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Oh, they got here as well.
Yeah.
Whenever you read any history, you're like, we went there. That's so far. Why did we go there? Because we just wanted to. Mm-hmm. We got really good at going places.
We got really good at going to places and taking things.
Yeah.
And so the Turkish Civil War started, or the Cyprus Civil War, rather, I should say, started in end of 1963.
Wow.
And then by March 1964, my grandfather was killed in it. But it's been a massive thing that's just always hung over my family and always hung over everything that we've done. Because it was done in such a brutal way as yeah. well. Like, he was captured with other men, lots of whom we were related to, and like marched to this Greek Cypriot, he was like a pig farmer, and marched him to this guy's house. They marched all of them to this guy's house and then tortured and killed them, like, quite brutally. And there's a photographer, and no one's quite sure who the photographer is. Mm. Some people say it was a Turkish photographer, other people say it was a British photographer, who took a photograph of all of the men, all of their bodies, when they were dead.
Oh my God.
And the second person closest to the photograph is my granddad. And this was a really, like, famous photo in Cyprus that gets used a lot when people are, well, I mean, I guess in terms of, like, remember the war.
So we
grew up with that photo. Like, the first time my dad ever saw that picture was hanging on the wall of a museum in North Cyprus, like 2 years after his dad had been killed.
So did he know it existed, the photo?
I'm not sure. I think he knew that there was rumour of it, but wasn't 100%.
That's really weird that no one knows who took it.
Yeah.
That's really, like,
I know.
Mad, isn't
because
it?
A lot of people was like, oh, it was a British journalist. But then, you know, I was talking to my dad about it, and there's also something quite colonial about that.
Yeah.
You sort of, you know, it's always like the truth tellers are always like the British.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's no one's quite sure.
I would have thought if it was a British journalist, there would be like a record of it, and it would have been sent to his paper, and you know, that they would have been the paper that or something you could track them down.
Also, because it's an image that was used every single year on the front page of Turkish newspapers on the anniversary of my granddad's death, like every single year up until relatively recently. So you would think that there would be, like, with an image that's that sort of renowned in that country, you would think somebody would have been like, yeah, I took that picture. But for whatever reason...
That's so weird.
For whatever reason, no one knows. But yeah, so we always... Like, that was the first picture I ever saw of him, like, with it, half his head missing.
Oh, my God. So when you first saw it, how old were you? Can you remember?
Must have been really, really young.
Yeah.
Like, I think, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 or 8. Maybe a little bit older.
Do you remember it being explained to you what happened to him?
It was always explained to me.
Wow.
Because, I mean, both my parents lived through the same war.
Mm.
And my dad was a prisoner of war twice. And, like, all of the men in my family, like, who were old enough, all fought in it and were also prisoners of war. So you couldn't really escape it. So, you know, in order to understand, not even history, just, like, my family's existence, like, my parents, like, immediate who they are, is that, like, that's what they've come from.
Yeah, so your dad was a teenager when that
my
war
dad was
started?
My dad was, both my parents would have been 13, just turned 13, 12, 13 when the war started.
That's so nuts,
and,
isn't it?
Yeah, and he was 13 when his dad was killed, and he was a soldier from that age, from 13 up until, I don't know, mid to late 20s.
I still just find that mind-blowing.
Yeah, pretty sad.
Because I was talking to someone the other day about, I think it was the Arthur Smith episode, where we were talking about his dad and World War II and my grandpa, and we were saying, you know, like, oh, it's this sort of faraway world and it's hard to imagine what it was like. And then you forget, of course, that's a very white English perspective on it of like, well, my dad wasn't a soldier at 13 because I'm not thinking about wars that were really not that far away.
Right.
So for you to talk about your dad being a soldier, do you know what I mean? That's that normally a much older person
would
be like.
Yeah, you're used to it being like a few generations removed from you, and it's like tales
Arthur's in his
60s,
and he's like, my dad was fought in Germany, and you're like, right, oh yeah, I see, that's a world of films that I kind of get, but I don't. But yeah, for you to be like, yeah, yeah. One generation ago, my dad was a soldier.
Yeah. I mean, I was born in 1983, and the ceasefire was in 1974. So it's not, you know, It wasn't that long before I was born. I've one of my oldest cousins was born during the war. You know, it's very, very recent. It's like literally the thing that all of my family, because my mum's Turkish Cypriot as well, have lived through.
It's just really, I suppose the other thing is, like, because there's so much conflict that I remember growing up, I definitely knew about the Cypriot War, and then it drifted into all the other wars that Britain was involved in. And so then sort of remember that, like, I remember people, because we're both from North London, and I remember someone saying, oh, they're Greek Cypriot, and me being like, oh, whoa, what's that? Like, no, that's a day.
It's
like
different.
You're going on holiday to the Turkish bit.
Right.
So don't tell them that you're going to that bit, because it'll just start a conversation that they might not want to have, and be like, oh, right, okay. But it not being, but you're right, there's such an incredibly near war. God, that's
But with a lot of history that has been erased around it.
Yeah.
Because even though, like, yeah, growing up in North London, people know that there's a difference between a Greek Cypriot and a Turkish Cypriot, because a lot of us live in North London and East London. But there is still a lot of erasure about, like, what that country, like, looks like. And the fact that actually, like, there is a border in the middle, and that the north part, which is the Turkish part, is a lot like Palestine in that it's a pseudo-state. It's not a recognised country. Like, you can't fly directly to North Cyprus. You have to touch down in Turkey. The only place that can land in North Cyprus is a flight from Turkey. So no matter where you're coming from in the world, if you're going to the Turkish part of Cyprus, you've got to get a connecting flight from Turkey to get there, because no one else in the world recognises it. You know, and Yeah, there's a lot of erasure of kind of our economic situation, and, like, there's no import-export laws. You can't, you know, we're not a recognised country, and we haven't been since 1970. I'm not going to work out how long that is, because I can't do maths. But
no, neither can I.
Since 1974 is a long time.
Yeah, that's so mad, isn't it? Yeah, I've been to Turkish Cyprus, and I'd forgotten that we had to do that we touched down in Turkey. I completely forgot that, because it was a while ago.
Which also makes it more expensive and a much longer journey.
Yeah. I remember being like, oh, this is annoying that we have to do this.
Yeah, what could be like a 4-hour flight ends up being like an 8-hour journey because of that. It's annoying. God.
So you remember being explained, okay, this is your granddad. Did your parents talk about, like, did your dad talk about how he felt about that grief, or was it kind of like, because there's, like you said, there was so much, you'd all been affected by it. It wasn't like, oh, let's pinpoint this one thing.
No, he didn't. He didn't, actually. I did a show with him recently. I did Shortcuts for for Radio 4, BBC 4. Is that right, BBC 4?
BBC Radio 4.
BBC Radio 4, So I did Shortcuts with him, and I read, like, a little piece about it, and they got him on with me to talk about it. And that's probably the first time I've ever heard him talk about his actual feelings rather than, like, the events around it. But, yeah, because it was always just, like, it was always facts.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's always been quite stoic about it. The one thing that I do remember is every year he would, like, for a few weeks before the anniversary, he'd get really, like, kind of difficult to be around, which is not my dad at all. Like, he is just, like, the softest, like, kindest, easiest person. Like, he's not a moody person at all. He's a very gentle person. But for a few weeks before the anniversary, he'd just become kind of unbearable and a bit sort of moody and snappy. And he would take the photo out, like, every single night and just study it. And you just couldn't interrupt him. And me and my mum would just be like, all right, allow it. We'll just have to leave you to it. But he doesn't do that anymore. He's much, I don't know, I think the older he's got, he's in his 60s now, late 60s. Like, I think kind of the more comfortable he's got in growing older, I think the better that reaction is from him. I think it might have been a lot worse when he was around the age that his dad was, when his dad was killed. And that mentality of, like, you're suddenly older than, like, that parent, you know.
That is a huge thing.
Is it?
Yeah, because you're always looking for milestones, I think, because you don't have them. So you're always looking for, like things that are significant. So my dad died when I was 15, and last year was the 20th anniversary. I've been trying to like style it out and just say 20 so people can't guess my age, but it's you listeners know it was last year. And that became so significant for me, so significant, because it's just like that number going, well, that's way longer. That's 5 years more than I knew him. And then here we are.
Right.
And then my brother, he's not quite there yet, but he's coming up to the age my dad was. And I know that's going to be for all of us, I think. It's just weird when life gives you really clear markers.
Right.
So you can be sad about them. You're like, oh, I'm sad. Oh, well, I'm sad. But then when you're like, oh, wow, Tom's nearly the same age. Oh, like it's suddenly like that. It like helps you process it in a way. And I can't imagine how your dad must have felt when you have such a traumatic image to look at. Like, you know, I have traumatic memories that through time it's got easier to kind of go, okay, replace some of those with like when he was alive. And perhaps that's what your dad has done, is replace them. But I don't have a photo of the day he died. And also he died of cancer. So it was like, he looked awful. But
yeah,
to die in such a violent way.
Yeah.
And to have a picture of it.
Yeah.
Must be at one time, not helpful, but kind of like, okay, I see that. That's what happened. There's the truth of it. Because often you're searching, you're like, I can't remember.
Yeah.
So I think any visual image, you're like, there it is. Yeah. That's what happened to me. But to see something so violent must be really fucking painful.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
I remember the first time I saw a photo of my granddad not looking like that.
Yeah.
I was maybe 14 or 15.
Wow.
And that scared me way more, because I don't think I ever understood that my granddad was anything other than this dead war hero, you know? And then suddenly you see this image of them where you're like, oh, scene. Okay, actually, like, they were a husband and a person and a father.
Yeah.
And I've missed out on having like a really lovely granddad.
Yeah.
And then so that it sort of switches that perspective, and it stops being this tragic war story. And suddenly you're like, this was a man. This was actually a man. Because they're not a man when you're looking at that dead body.
Yeah.
They're not. And I don't know if that's because I went to the Don McCullen exhibition yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
there are loads of pictures.
He's a war photographer.
The war photographer. And there are lots of pictures of dead bodies at various wars. But interestingly, there's a massive section that he has on Cyprus. And there are photos that he has of, there are two different photos where my dad is related to two different people in those photos.
Wow.
And one of the guys in one of those photos is still alive, and I've met him, and he runs a chain of shoe shops in North Cyprus. And he learned how to become a shoemaker because he was an apprentice to my granddad, who was a shoemaker.
Wow.
And for a very long time, we were talking earlier about like not knowing who took the photo. For a very long time, I always fantasized that it was Don McCullen.
Yeah.
Because then it gave me some kind of like connection to like that day, beyond it just being this violent thing that exists for everybody else's politics.
Yeah.
And you don't get to have a say about like whether that's, you know, how you feel about it and what your relationship to that person is, rather than your relationship to that picture or that event or that war. It's a lot.
It's so much. Yeah. It's so much. We talk to all sorts of people, and you're always like, God, that's a lot. But this is a lot, I guess, because like you're saying, it's so much bigger than a family. Because normally we're so focused on like, okay, this is a family tragedy and the pain spirals from this person out into the family. But once you reach, you know, friends, you can see the pain, not distancing, but getting lighter, because it is. Whereas this is so much, it's about such a bigger subject that it feels very heavy.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking as well, like, you know, all the photos of my dad, like I can't imagine, it would make me feel so sick if somebody else had a photo and they could just pop it out.
Yeah.
Like I'd be like, and we've talked to people who've had famous parents. And, you know, they've said sometimes you just fucking hear them on the radio and it's like, oh no warning. And I guess it's a similar thing, but it's always wrapped in that tragedy of the war, isn't it?
Yeah, because it is. And also because other people then end up appropriating what is your very personal relationship with your grandfather or your father or your husband. And I remember, it wasn't even that long ago, like I remember being in Kyrenia, North Cyprus, with like all of, like, loads of my family, and it was really hot, and we were walking to go get ice cream or beer or something, and me and my dad were, like, walking through this, like, crowd of people, and there was this massive, like, almost like billboard that was up in the middle of the square with loads of photos of the war on it. Must have been an anniversary, and we were sort of like, excuse me, like trying to get through the crowd. And then we just suddenly see this massive photograph of my granddad,
oh,
like,
in
that state, like that particular photo. And, you know, my dad just went, like, really silent. And you see, like, there's just crowds of people just sort of pawing at this photo. And you're like, I wasn't ready for this. Like, we were just, like, walking next to a harbour trying to get some ice cream on, like, a Tuesday afternoon or whatever. And then suddenly you have to be like, oh, cool, that's you know, that's my dead dad. Like, there he is, you know? It's a lot.
It's so much. And it's funny because we talk about this so much on the show of, like, Mother's Day or Father's Day, you know, and you get an email like, celebrate Mother's Day with chocolate. And you're like, oh, fucking hell. Like, I wasn't prepared for that today.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you're in the park and you see... I get old man, that's what I get, like an old man playing with some kids. And you're like, oh, that's the granddad my child will never ever have. But for you, it's an added layer of, I was going to say bigness. Trump is catching, guys. He's catching. Of what's a grandness, I guess, because I guess for those people, like you said, he's a martyr.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and that and he's become meaningful to them in a different way, which is why they want that image, which is why they use that image on the papers. You know, it means that this is it. We were wronged and we fought, and our country still matters.
Yeah. And don't forget them.
Like, yeah, but you're right. It's the personal, because it's not a dead. It's not an anonymous dead body.
No, it isn't.
And it makes me think of all those war pictures that, you know, like those famous ones. There's that famous one, isn't it, of the kiss on VE Day in New York with the guy, like, bending over.
Oh, yeah.
And didn't they, like, track down the woman? And she was like, I didn't know. And he just grabbed me and shoved his tongue down my throat. It was actually really horrible.
Yeah.
And it was a really, like, they were all kissing people. And it was actually really horrible being in the streets that day.
Yeah.
But to the picture, you're like, oh, look how happy America was. And it's like, the story behind the picture is always, like you said, the personal behind the political, I suppose.
Right, exactly.
It's so massive.
Which is when that photo of Aylan Cody, the child that, the photograph of the child face down who had drowned. Like, I get it. I get the importance of seeing a picture like that, because it changed a lot of minds about what the refugee crisis is and what it looks like. But there's also something deeply problematic about having to see dead brown and black bodies in order to humanise the politics behind it.
It's so problematic. And it reminds me of advertising. Because what you see is you go, oh, it works like the way adverts work.
Exactly.
Is you're going, like, you know, like, oh, that lady's got really shiny white teeth. I want shiny white teeth. Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks. That made me realise what I want. And that's what they did with that little boy, was maybe go, oh, little boy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's not okay.
Yeah.
And it was a really, that photo is fascinating, because it was a really weird period where suddenly all those papers that peddled the most disgusting anti-immigrant
rhetoric
constantly, suddenly were like, this is awful.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, you know, it's almost like, like your racist friend is suddenly not racist. You're like, oh, this is weird. Why are they? Okay. Okay, great. I'm going to encourage it.
Yeah.
And it was like this brief moment. And then it felt to me like it just went away again. And it was like, well, actually, you know, it's all... Obviously, it's very sad. But let's not get emotional.
Yeah, exactly.
Because actually, there's a bigger problem here.
Yeah.
But you said for a brief moment, it did fucking help. And there was this huge wave of people that were like, oh my God, I'm going to get involved. And people going to the refugee camps and donating. And that was brilliant. But
the fact that that's what it takes.
I know.
The fact that that's what it takes for people to start humanising it. Like, that's, you know, and it's interesting what you're saying about, like, the response of the papers as well. But because... the only reason why they had to then try and humanise this dead child and this political crisis is because they were the fucking ones that were talking about how shit refugees are and immigrants are anyway. You know, and it's the exact same thing with the Christchurch shootings, where it's like the newspapers are still profiting off Muslim trauma. because they're, you know, they're now selling papers off the back of these are the victims of this terrorist attack in Christchurch, and how horrific and how awful, and never forget these people. But you're the same fucking papers that got people like this, who, you know, didn't actually need very much to work out who their target was going to be, to go in there and shoot those people, because you've spent the last God knows how many decades talking about how all Muslims are terrorists, and if you don't kill them, they'll kill you first.
So your family, like, are they, do people know then that that's your, like you said, your surname is Martin? Do people know, like, that's your granddad from the picture? Is that
for the, I mean, yeah, for the most part, people, but it's a very small island. Like, yeah, I mean, yeah. I genuinely think there are fewer Turkish Cypriots in Cyprus than there are in Haringey, like genuinely.
Yeah.
So we're a small community. I mean, so people do know, for the most part, who my family is, largely because these are other families and communities that have grown up with each other for so long. But generally, when you do say the name, like, Shehit Olu, even if they can't work out exactly, like, which martyr your granddad is, like, they still already know that it's one of, you know, that it's someone significant.
Yeah.
Because they take their martyrs very seriously. And, you know, there is a lot of respect, because it's such recent history.
And it
hasn't, the war hasn't even ended, really. It's just like, it's just a ceasefire.
It's just ceasefire, isn't it? It's not fixed or finished or ended in a neat narrative.
No.
Not and that any war is, but
no. But there are also physical memories of that war everywhere in that island anyway. It's like, I remember my grandmother's house. She passed away as well, only a few years ago. And we used to go to her house, and there were bullet holes all over the walls.
Wow.
And like all over the windows, and her bedroom, like, the floor was like made of like stone, I guess. Like, there was a massive blood stain like on the floor that couldn't be fully washed away because it had sunk into whatever the stone was that made her floor. And you just got used to it. We just used to play like that, where it was like, okay, that's the blood stain of some dude that was killed here. And this is when they moved, when my grandmother got moved into that house. So she had lost her house in the south, and then I guess the border went up, so Turkish Cypriots went on one side, Greek Cypriots on the other. So she got, like a lot of people did, like, you know, a lot of refugees on both sides, both Greeks and Turks. She got given a house, but everything was so fresh after the war that I remember my family saying that when they moved her in, there was something like 15 or 16 bodies just like all around the house and in the garden.
Oh my God. They
buried all of those bodies in the garden. I remember, this is how fucked up it is and how used to it we were. I remember being about 8 or 9 years old and trying with my cousins, who were all a similar age, trying to dig up one of the bodies. Of course we didn't get very far. We also scared the shit out of ourselves.
Of course,
quite
but if someone told you there's 8 bodies in the garden,
of course you're gonna,
your group of kids, you're gonna dig
exactly
that up.
Exactly.
Absolutely, there's no way one of you's not gonna go,
exactly,
do you wanna get a spade and dig up a body?
Exactly. Like, exactly. And I, like, you know, and it was such a part of it was such a normal part of our childhood, you know, which of itself is fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
That you think that just walking around your grandmother's house with some, you know, poor man's blood still on that floor, and you're like, yeah, sure, this is how we live. Bullet holes everywhere in her house, like everywhere.
I mean, it is terrible, but it's also sort of like massively important that we talk about it, it feels, because... this is maybe a stupid thing to say, but I used to be a tour guide in London, and like part of the bit that you used to say is you point out there's so many churches and buildings in London that have bomb damage, and I don't think people realise. It's like Tate Britain is covered in it. There's this church on the Strand, and people they just think they're old buildings. And if you look, you go, I mean, obviously it's bomb. Like, when you realise that, you're like, you can see the shrapnel, and it doesn't look like that's been worn away.
Yeah.
You're like, that's a fucking bomb that landed
here. Yeah.
And people would always be really like, whoa. Because you're like, where you're standing on the Strand right now, a bomb dropped.
Yeah.
And this church survived it. Or, you know, St. Paul's is covered in bomb damage. And I think stuff like that's really important because, as you said, that war is getting very far away for people now. So it's like, oh, right. But of course your grandmother's house is covered. That's what had happened.
Yeah, and everybody's houses were. Like, well, the older houses anyway, not obviously not the houses built afterwards, but all of the houses that, you know, that survived that time. They're all like that. I mean, you walk around just like the city centre, like Lefkosha, Nicosia as the English know it. And it's like, again, you see all the sides of the big buildings. You see like bits of, you know, bits of the building that come away from shrapnel.
Yeah.
And no man's land is a really interesting thing as well, which is where the UN are. Because it's actually it's quite narrow. It runs through the capital, which is shared by both the north and the south. And it's essentially it's like people's houses that where people couldn't return to them. And you can see like the windows that are open and people's furniture is still in there.
Wow.
And everything was just like these are people's houses, like just left untouched since 1974. Like windows still open, sandbags along like both sides, and it's really narrow. You can see either side like quite easily, with a Greek Cypriot soldier on one side, Turkish Cypriot on our side, and then a UN, I guess, in the middle. It's a constant like haunting reminder of war in Cyprus. Certainly in the north. I don't know. I can't really speak for the south. I haven't been to the south for a very long time. But the north in particular is still quite a haunted place.
And how do you feel like that's affected you? Because like I think there is, I'm not trained, but like there is a sense of inherited grief sometimes when a big trauma has been in the family. Like, do you feel like? Do you feel how? Yeah, did it affect you having that grief, that heavy grief around?
Well, I mean, it's a funny thing. It's physically affected me.
Yeah,
but my hair is grey, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I've had grey hair since I was 8 years old. It's not.
I thought it was dyed.
No.
Oh my god, because it's so trendy now.
It is very trendy now.
And You're right on board, Jermaine.
It's very grey, and it's been turning grey since I was 8, and very grey since I was 15. That's a trauma gene.
Wow.
My dad started to turn grey when he was 13 when his dad got murdered, and he's the only person in his family who has it. It was a direct response to stress, and he kept that trauma gene and passed it on to me. So I'm literally wearing that shit on my head. Like, I literally carry that trauma gene. I carry that trauma around on my head, like, physically. But I don't think it's a surprise, like, what I do for a living. I don't think it's a surprise, like, what I tend to talk a lot about. I write a lot about identity, which I guess is different. I guess that's because I grew up here separated from all of it. But I spend a lot of time writing and working about like race and equality and human rights. And, you know, I try and bring Cyprus into my work as much as I possibly can, because whilst there are a lot of us in London, a lot of us don't have a voice. A lot of us aren't telling our story.
Well, and as we were saying, like we both grew up in North London. So I'm fully aware of Turkish Cypriot and Greek Cypriot. But if you're not from North London, you might not even know there was a bloody war there.
No,
like,
no, absolutely, absolutely. Or you've had a slightly different narrative of that war, which is largely that, like, you know, it's always referred to as being the Turkish invasion of 1974, which whilst Turkey intervened in 1974 and that's when the ceasefire started, it's very misleading language, because an invasion sort of suggests that there weren't Turkish people living on that island before that, or that Turkish people didn't have a right to be on that island before that, which is nonsense.
But I think that you said that trauma gene is really interesting, because there is this massive theory now of epigenetics, isn't it? That your, you know, genes change in trauma and you can inherit things, and a child born under, you know, during a wartime will have different genetic makeup. And that, like, when you start thinking about it, is mind-blowing, because I think for so long we've just been like, no, these things don't affect you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, of course, how can it not? How can something not? That's what I was thinking of, like, something as traumatic, because it was such a violent death.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that image of that violent death as a memory of that violent death, like, of course that's going to affect your dad. And of course, even if you ignored all genetics and you just went just psychologically, you know, he's, you know, the way he's going to parent is going to be affected by that. Mm-hmm. Not to say he wasn't a brilliant parent.
Well, no,
but
the way he parented was affected by that in a massively positive way. He was a very, and still is, an incredibly present father.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that he wouldn't have always had that in him anyway. But I imagine that there's probably something in that with growing up without, you know, without a dad. And having to also become a dad to your siblings at quite an early age.
Like, I mean, at 13, that's like ridiculous.
There were five of them, five siblings, and he's the oldest boy, and he's the second oldest child. So, like, my aunt, who's 15, he was 13, and the two of them, And my grandmother was so insanely depressed throughout her life, actually, that, like, my dad and his sister kind of had to become the mum and dad, and they had to work from that age to pay for their siblings to go to school and to university, rather, and to live. You know, they became the parents in absence of having a dad and having a mum who was so traumatised that actually for a very long time she couldn't really function.
Did she ever talk about it to you?
Or no, was
it
never. No? Absolutely never. She never married again. She never had anything to do with another man again. The only story I've heard, stories never from her. I heard a story that when she found out that he was dead, she smashed a plate over her head. And I think that was it. I think she shut down after that. Wow. She was a very loving, very present grandmother, and I assume parent as well, certainly in like later years. Like very, very warm, very funny person, so very emotionally open in that sense, but like she wouldn't talk about the war. She never really talked about him. It took a very long time for her to even put photos of him up.
Wow.
And what was interesting with those photos of the reason why I was 14 when I first saw a picture of him alive was because so much was burnt and lost in the war.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
So apparently some neighbours had saved a couple of photos for them, which no one realised that they'd had, or this woman had. And for whatever reason, it took her a very long time to kind of track my family down and be like, by the way, I, before I die, before something happens to me, here's a bunch of photos that I saved from your house. And that's wow. So I was like 14, I think, around the time those photos of him with my grandmother, and there's one of him with my grandmother, my dad and his older sister. And there's another one of him with one of his brothers. And those are the only three that I know of that exist. But it took her, I was probably in my 20s by the time she actually put those pictures up on the wall. Like, she just... It was never really, even on his anniversary, the anniversary of his death, like, my dad would always call her on that day. And she knew why, but, like, they just wouldn't talk about it.
I mean...
What's there to say?
What's there to say? Yeah, you can understand. There's no right, or we always say this, there's no right or wrong way to talk about things. And with something as, like, violent, traumatic as that, like, how do you say to your, you know... aging mother, like, there's nothing to say, but I can only take comfort that that woman had the foresight to grab some photos. Like, that's
kind of
amazing.
I know.
Like, because I think it's also really important in not healing that trauma, because you're not going to heal it, but the fact that you then did see him alive and you did see a happiness and that helped you realize a person. Like, I think stuff like that, and that's what they talk about a lot when, you know, you... and someone dies, inverted commas, like the normal way or the boring way, quieter way, is you have a lot of traumatic memories of them maybe being sick in hospital.
Right.
And over time, like, they try and help you to replace them with, like, them being alive and being healthy. And for years, I could only see my dad in, like completely yellow because he had it spread to his liver, and, like, in the clothes he wore when he was sick. And it took me years to suddenly have a memory. I was like, oh, yeah, he was... That's like him laughing and wearing a suit and being alive and being a person, because things that are traumatic burn into your memory stronger than happy memories.
Absolutely.
You know, so but it's so important to try, like you said, like you did, to replace them, to see a person, because I think that is... I use processing as a word lightly, but that is part of processing what happened to someone, of being like, oh, I see, they weren't just, like you said, they weren't just that...
Mm-hmm.
photo on the front page of that newspaper. They were a dad and a brother and a husband.
And that they're not just political.
Yeah.
And that they don't just exist for other people's politics, you know. But, like I said, it's like all of the work that I do is so kind of politically, racially charged. And, like, it has to be because of this.
Yeah.
Like, I genuinely can't think of any other reason why it's such a fixation for me.
Yeah.
To feel so frustrated by how easy it is to fuck up everybody's life because you told a set of lies about a group of people. You know, that's it. That's literally like, if you want, like, the most basic terms, like, you just sat there and you said a bunch of shit for long enough about a group of people, and this is where we ended up.
Mm.
You know?
Well, it makes me just think of, like, the importance of language, like you said, yeah. The importance of language and just like the weight of words. Like, and that's why I think this book, coming back to it, is so interesting. And I urge people to read it, especially if we all live, it's such a, I feel like such a dick saver. It's like we all live on this one place. We have to like work out how to talk to each other.
Right.
That's right. It. Then it doesn't mean any, like there isn't a right or wrong. It's not as clear as that, but we have to come to each other with the carefulness of our words.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
When you think about refugee crisis or, you know, the way immigration is used politically now and the way wars are used politically, yeah. It's important, like you said, to remember the personal,
yeah.
That you're talking about people.
Yeah.
You're
and
not
how,
talking
how
about...
divisive, how dangerous that divisive language yeah. is. I remember my cousin was a, when he was doing his national service, he was on, they put him on that, on the border, where the, just like that very narrow border in the capital. And he was absolutely terrified. Like, I was just like, you know, 18, 19-year-old, like, really, like, you know, a young man, like, kid, basically. And he remembers one night, like, it was so close to, like, the other side. And there's this other, like, 17, 18, 19-year-old Greek yeah. Cypriot kid who's clearly just as terrified. And he said that after a while, like, they would roll cigarettes to each other and, like, throw magazines of, like naked women, you know, at each other. And that's so beautiful for me because yeah. you realise that, like, what's separating these two people, in the most simplistic terms, is language and religion. And beyond that, that's absolutely it. Greek and Turkish Cypriots have the exact same DNA as each other, which is different to the DNA that we have, that we share, or that we don't share, rather, with Turks from Turkey and Greeks from Greece.
Wow.
We are the same race, essentially. And the only thing separating us is, our culture is exactly the same as well. Like, the only thing separating us is language and religion. But ultimately, like, that, when he told me that, I was like, you're just boys.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. Like, no matter what language you're coming at this from, you are still boys that want to see tits.
And, like, have a fag.
Like, that's it. And you get that. You get that on a fundamental human level. You're still boys, you know? And that, like, that was a really beautiful thing for me, but also a very sad thing as well to realise. You're physically divided by just such an abstract idea of difference.
That's a really beautiful story. I like ending on boys and tits. Let's end there. Shemaine, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
About this incredible book and your situation. And say your granddad's name for me.
Suleiman Recep.
Suleiman Recep. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can follow Shemaine on Twitter at Shemaine Suleiman. That's CHIMENESULEYMAN. And her book, which she co-edited with Nikesh Shulker, is called The Good Immigrant USA and is available to buy now, and I thoroughly recommend it. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.